Welcome to the More Perfect Union Podcast, a regular discussion on the state of American politics and current events with entertaining and respectful commentary from across the political spectrum. Welcome to the More Perfect Union, a podcast about the joy we get from American politics. By the way, we are not affiliated with Ben Carson, his works of fiction, his life, or in some instances, both. Find more about us at moreperfectpodcast.com. Go to Facebook, facebook.com/moreperfectunionpodcast, and take a couple minutes to rate and review us on iTunes. We could use it, and you can let the whole world know what we're doing here. So my name is Alan. I'm a dentist from Saginaw, Michigan. Kind of libertarian-ish, kind of moderate, kind of lean to the right.
Hi, I'm DJ, a cost estimator and economics instructor from Suffolk, self-described economic conservative and self-confessed Republican.
My name is Greg. I'm a stay-at-home dad from Cincinnati, Ohio. I am an obvious liberal Democrat.
I'm Jonah. I'm an independent from Maryland, some kind of health, nutrition, exercise person.
And I'm Kevin, a stay-at-home television writer for some reason. And I am a Democrat, but hopefully not too liberal.
All right, thanks, guys. How about we start with our headlines? We'll start with mine. I found a very colorful, pretty headline in the New York Times that was that regarded the 2016 presidential election super PAC donors found that, like, a huge percentage of all of the money given so far has been from 158 families at this point. So it was really, when I read it, it kind of turned my stomach. Most of the money that's been given so far for these candidates or for the PACs, the super PACs, from a very, very small amount of people. So not that that's surprising, but it was just interesting how they quantified it, how they kind of threw it right out there so you could see it in your face. So basically, none of us really have anything to do with this. It's all being taken care of by the richest of the rich. So just want to let you know that.
I have seen too many candidates blow too much money down too many drains to swallow that whole money is important. I will agree with that, but the paramount issue is votes, and money cannot buy you votes if the candidate is bad or if the campaign is bad. Now, if you've got good candidates and good campaigns, then money could have it. Then money could be important.
Oh, but I'll disagree. I'm going to jump in there. We have seen in the past bad candidates with bad campaigns with huge tracts of land, okay, not literally by votes, but with flashy campaigns, charts, and graphs, and I'm looking at Ross Perot.
I was looking at his ears, actually.
Okay, Kerry was not a good candidate, even as a Democrat, and yet lots of money, okay?
And who was the alternative that year?
Bush.
You know, I'm talking about,
no, the alternative Democrat.
Oh, the alternative Democrat?
Democratic Party.
Oh, Edwards. Edwards was a fine.
Yeah, Edwards was a bit of a self-destruction thing, though, with him.
But we didn't know that at the time.
Yeah, but I mean, I would say right now that like Hillary is very comfortable right now in her lead, even though everyone's making out like she's not. She is, because she has all the money.
Yeah, money's huge in campaigns.
I think I am cynical enough to think that money is pretty much everything, actually.
And I have seen enough of these to say that it is not everything.
And lucky for all of us, this is basically Larry Lessig's one issue. So good for us, because he'll be in the debate this week and we'll learn a lot more about it.
He will be in the debate?
Oh, no.
Oh, wait a second. Oh, that's right.
No, we'll get to that, I guess.
Hey, I agree. Citizens United is one of the most terrible things in the world. But
that's perhaps a debate for another day. However, my understanding is DJ has a headline for us.
Yes, I do. It is a column from Larry Summers, who is Bill Clinton's last Treasury Secretary, says the global economy is in danger. And I have to tell you, I was thoroughly disgusted at the drivel that he spewed out in this thing. I mean, This is
I thought he was selling gold, actually.
No, that's a different graphic. Different guy. But he didn't even bother to propose a policy of any kind. It was just more deficits, more spending. I mean, I have been in this field now for 25 years, and this is all the Keynesians do. Everything is a nail to them. This is the economic equivalent of more cowbell. They never stop with this, saying the same thing over and over and over again. And it didn't work in the 1970s. It didn't work in the early 80s. It didn't work in the aughts when Bush the Younger actually did it and none of them noticed. Why would they think it is suddenly going to work now?
I don't know. I think that's
40 to 50 years.
That's an entire economic. That's their thing, man.
I want to jump in and ask DJ something because I actually liked the article. But then again, I do not have your knowledge of economics, and I'm not going to pretend that I do. But my question is, why do you say that Keynesian economic theory did not work in the early 80s and in the early 90s? Because it seems to me that we had two strong economies during those periods.
I said the 70s and the early 90s. I did not refer to the 1980s.
I'm sorry. My mistake.
No, that's right. The early 1990s was the Bush tax increase of 1990 and the Clinton tax increase of 1993 and the spending increases that came with them. The mid to late 90s, essentially, Clinton sort of shifted gears because he was dealing with a Republican Congress. He focused more on restraining spending, and the 1997 Clinton-Gingrich budget deal included some very good supply-side tax reductions and some spending restraint that helped create what was at the time a relatively slow recovery and made it into a relatively strong recovery in the late 1990s. So yes, the Clinton administration and Bill Clinton himself does deserve credit, in my opinion, for lack of a better term, recognizing he made a mistake in his first term and being much stronger in his second term. The irony is, Bush the Younger, when he came in, he came up with a gigantic temporary tax cut, which frankly a lot of supply-siders, including me, went along with because we thought going big was important. We now know otherwise. The lack of permanence in that completely sank the thing from a supply-side perspective, made it just one of those Johnson temporary tax cuts that he always tried to use that blew up in his face. Obviously, two wars are a massive Keynesian stimulus, even though most people don't want to admit that they are. And even at the end of the administration, the tax rebate of 2008 was just another Keynesian prime pumping type of deal. So we've actually gone through this, not just in the Obama administration, which I think did it a little differently in their 2009 plan. We can get into that later if we want. But Bush actually tried what Summers wants, really, really wants to try. And it just didn't work as well. And that's why I focused it to the early 90s and the 1970s, because you're right. The late 1990s was very, very good. And credit does go to Bill Clinton for that. But credit goes to him because he shifted gears on economic policy.
Greg, give us a headline.
OK, there's an article.
I've been expected to sleep tonight. Damn.
There was an article in the College Newer. It's written by a young lady, and it says, "No, John Kasich, I don't want Taylor Swift tickets." But it could have been, and anyone from Ohio knows this, it could have just been said, "John Kasich is an a-." And everyone in Ohio knows this, and I'm kind of letting everyone else know this. He's just a jerk. And I know we wouldn't get to talk to – we never talk about Kasich. We never say, oh, where's Kasich polling at? Because he's not going to win. But he's had this problem forever, and it's also kind of a problem with, once again, how's that outreach going for you guys? So John Kasich was at a event, and it was a forum at a college, but it was mostly older people. And a young lady in the back, she was 18 years old, raises her hand. And he goes, oh, you. No, I'm sorry. I don't have Taylor Swift tickets. And everyone got a laugh out of her, blah, blah, blah. And she was like, wait, I came here to learn. I wanted this. Once again, just a jerk. And he has this whole history of doing this. Last week, he told Social Security people, hey, you'll get over it. You'll just have to get over it. When he told them, I'm going to cut your Social Security because that's what I have to do to balance the budget. He called a cop an idiot repeatedly for doing his job when he got pulled over, and then pulled the, hey, do you know who I am? And in fact, as far back as 1991, this is my favorite story, John Kasich went to a Grateful Dead concert, tried to get them pulled off, and went backstage screaming, and he was a congressman back then, do you know who I am? And it was really, so this is my favorite part. John Kasich, governor of Ohio, is just such an a-hole. But also, how's that outreach going? Mean to, and just condescending to young ladies, to the elderly, to police, to hippies, you know, his entire life.
So what's his demo?
His demo?
Yeah.
Other assholes, yes.
Yeah, people that don't know him.
Like middle-aged white guys, basically.
Middle-aged white guys. I should love this guy. Yeah. But...
and people who actually voted for Ronald Reagan, people who are old enough to vote in 1980.
Yeah. He should be my best friend, but, you know.
It's not working, huh?
Right. No, no.
Jonah, give us a headline.
All right, so instead of a headline, I'm going to refer you to a C-SPAN video. So what's going on right now is, it's 2.5 hours long. So, but that's okay.
Yeah, I'll get right on that. Thanks.
So I wanted to bring this up for two reasons. First is that as a podcast fan, C-SPAN has a podcast feed, and every week they put out notable committee hearings and speeches. So I actually listened to this on their podcast. But so Secretaries Vilsack and Burwell from Agriculture and Health and Human Services testified before Congress this week about the development of the 2015 dietary guidelines. And so it is very seldom that my industry ends up with actual political news. So I had to tell you about this. So basically what has happened is the way that the dietary guidelines are developed is that there are many components to it. And one of them is that there is an official committee, an advisory committee that is set up. And the controversy, there's actual real controversy right now about this because the Dietary Guidelines Advisory Committee, which is supposed to look at all the science and say, the science says we should do this. After they did that, they started proposing specific policy, which is not what they're supposed to do. I'm the only one laughing. It's hilarious. Trust me. So what they started to do in their report was to make recommendations about taxes and about like larger sweeping legislation that needed to be made for sustainability and all this kind of stuff. And that is not their job at all. Their job is to say, yeah, eat some vegetables. And here's why. So because of that, these two secretaries, for the first time, did a co-appearance before the House Agriculture Committee to answer these questions. Now, that's the backstory. The good stuff, if you want to see our Congress in action, you watch this video or listen to it, because these people have no idea what they're talking about at all for 2.5 hours. They're asking questions about, I heard a rumor that you were going to say it's bad to eat meat. No. No, that's not going to be there. Okay, because someone told me. No, we're. I don't think that's going to be in the recommendation. Okay,
it's that thing that where basically a lot of congresspeople are probably dumber than you are. That's the thing that you need to remember.
It's awesome. One guy spent his entire time talking about restaurants and why is it that the location of where you eat makes the food different, and was like, it is. An experience for your next 2.5 hour commute. But let me ask you guys this. So living outside DC and being aware of nutrition stuff, and DJ, you're outside DC, but the rest of you guys. Yeah. So what is your awareness of the dietary guidelines in general? Like what do you think they're for? Who are they for? Have you heard of them at all?
Well, I mean, I've heard lots of controversy about it because the problem is that, so is butter bad for you or is butter good for you? I mean, the science has actually gone back and forth like crazy. There's entire books written on how, you know, Gary Taubes or, you know, all this, that sort of stuff. There's entire concepts. So basically they're saying that you know, low fat, high carb, which was, you know, back in the early 80s, late 70s, that, you know, so now they're changing it. And the problem is not that they go on science, but that they are, that they get lobbied to, you know, or lobbied at, you know, all of a sudden it's, you know, the milk industry thinks milk needs to be a little higher up on the pyramid, blah, 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 that sort of thing. So it's a, it's, they claim to be backed by science when in reality they're backed completely by politics. Would that be right?
Well, what,
be. In fact, I think nothing is more, I got to admit, Jonah, the closest thing I ever got to paying attention to a dietary guideline was the, from Woody Allen's movie Sleeper, where the two doctors are talking about how everyone needs more steak and hot fudge. And and they're so confused about this guy, about Woody Allen's character from the 1970s who hates all that stuff. The scientists and the doctors, they thought those things were unhealthy, completely the opposite of what we know now. And the irony is, while we are not necessarily, I think, that far with hot fudge or even maybe steak yet, it's, you know, the science on that thing sort of has been shifting, really, the appearances of it has been shifting. But I will say, Jonah, that I am with you on this, that nothing is as funny as people in lab coats thinking they can be economists. It is a laugh riot to me. But that's just me.
So, Greg and Kevin, like, what is your interaction with the dietary guidelines?
Oh, it's mostly with my kids' school lunches.
Yeah.
Like, oh, well, we can't have, like, 4 chicken nuggets because that would put us way over, and we couldn't get federal funding and blah, blah, blah. Or you can't have maple syrup, so we're just having, or, you know, you have to have X amount. So we have to follow dietary guidelines. You know, oh, ketchup is now a vegetable.
Yeah, that was the Reagan thing.
Ketchup that was the Reagan. Yeah. That's
right. And pizza is qualified as a vegetable for as far as school lunches are concerned.
Oh, yeah. Right? Oh, yeah. Trust me, every Friday we have pizza.
A big vegetable dish.
Oh, where's that vegetable? And it actually says on the menu, tomato sauce. And I'm like, this hasn't seen a tomato in its entire life.
Well, in my,
hasn't
in
even
my
seen
household.
A ketchup packet.
In my household, we have a gluten-free eater, so I spend most of my energy trying to keep wheat and barley for our plates. Yeah. But I will tell you guys this, forgetting dietary guidelines, if you've never tried hot fudge cheesecake, try it now. It's amazing.
Duly noted.
Yeah. Yeah, no, so the big thing that sort of came out of this for me was the clarification about who they are intending the guidelines are for. Because if you think about it for a second, they're not for kids, because if you've not finished puberty, you need a different diet. They're not for seniors, because if you're over a certain age, you need a different diet. They're not for people with medical conditions, because then you need this specific diet. And none of the people on the committee sort of caught this, but that means that the dietary guidelines are specifically for about 1/3 or less of our population, because they're designed to keep you from getting sick. The secretary said a number of times that this is a preventative diet, and once you have something, you should stop eating this diet. And that I had never heard sort of expressed in those terms. It's like, oh, this is a lot of energy and resources being spent on one specific plan that applies to relatively few people.
Yeah, and I'm really uncomfortable having politicians laying this stuff out, you know, because clearly they can be swayed by lots of different things.
Now, I'll stop talking about this in a second, but the one exception that I would say is, like, in 2008, they put out the physical activity guidelines, and those are actually pretty fantastic, because what they did was they looked at all of the peer-reviewed credible science internationally and basically said, when we compare everything, this is what we know for sure. And that's a massive 700, 800 page document that is really good. But these dietary guidelines have some issues.
Interesting. All right, Kevin, give us your headline.
Okay, my headline is Jeb Bush would not reauthorize the Voting Rights Act. I thought this was an important article because, as you guys probably remember, the Voting Rights Act was reauthorized in 2006 after it passed the House by a vote of 390-3 and the Senate by 98-0. And at that time, when he signed it, George W. Bush said, "My administration will vigorously enforce the provisions of this law, and we will defend it in court." But this week, Jeb Bush, proving he's his own man, said he's going to prove that by gutting the law that his brother reauthorized, which I find ironic. And the other point that I wanted to make about this, that this means that Jeb Bush, the man who was supposed to open up the GOP's big tent, is now just slapping the faces of African-American voters. And if, you know, you may say, well, white voters may be of mixed opinions on the continued necessity of maintaining the Voting Rights Act, but I guarantee you, black voters are not of mixed opinion on it. And if he is nominated, they will take this issue and his comment into the voting booth in November.
How's that outreach going for you?
Yeah. I mean, you can chuckle about it, but I don't think a lot of Republicans are particularly worried about getting the black vote. I mean, that might be callous, but I'm pretty sure it's true.
Well, I mean, yes, you're right. But I mean, he was supposed to be the man, as I said, that was supposed to open up the big tent with Latinos, with other minorities. And this is not a step in that direction.
It wasn't with other minorities, Kevin. It was just with Latino Americans. Alan's comment may be callous, but it is also true. Most Republicans don't focus on African American.
Well,
votes.
I mean, and it isn't that they wouldn't. It's just that they're pretty wrapped up. I think or at least past elections have said essentially. Trump is killing him with African Americans though. So maybe Trump's the key.
In theory,
I'm not even kidding. I'm serious.
I know that, but there are swing voters in every constituency. I mean, 85 to 90% of African Americans will routinely vote for the Democrat, but there are usually about 5% that would be interested in voting for the Republican if the Republican ever bothered to talk to them, which they don't, and that includes Jeb Bush. I'll be honest about that. It is a huge problem that we have within the party, and this just emphasizes this. But I would say one other thing. This is the difference that the Supreme Court can do. The Supreme Court threw out Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act. And during that time, there has been little, if any, effort from what I've seen, any serious effort, to try to get that piece put back in. So outside of the African-American community, and Kevin is right, the African-American community is going to be very upset at this. And Jeb has really done a remarkable job of offending just about everyone except Latino Americans during his campaign. He's ticked off Asian Americans. He's ticked off African Americans. I don't know if he's gotten to Native Americans yet, but give him time.
Oh, yeah, give him a little while. No worries there.
But it is also a sign of sort of the shifting politics under that. And the politics really only shifted outside of the African American community with one court decision, and that was the Supreme Court knocking down Section 5. And in fact, African Americans themselves, outside of the partisan issue, are shifting their own positions on this, because here in Virginia, a number of African Americans are now suing to get the minority-majority districts that were drawn for their benefit 30 years ago, 20 years ago, 10 years ago, or 25 years ago, 15 years ago, 5 years ago, getting those thrown out because they no longer want to be gerrymandered into African American majority districts. They want to be 30 to 40% of white majority districts because they know that's enough to have an impact in deciding who wins and who loses. So outside of Jeb being stupid, which sadly is the new that's the new normal now. He is really, really rusty and he did it again. And outside of the partisan impact, and I think Kevin is right on that, how people view the Voting Rights Act is changing to some extent. It won't necessarily show up on when people vote in November, but it does show up in how they treat the Voting Rights Act in just about every other aspect of political life.
All right, you guys. Okay. Let's talk about other stuff. Someone tell me a little bit about the House Speaker race. What's going on there?
Oh, McCarthy's got it.
In the bag.
We have said that 2 weeks in a row now.
Yeah.
We're like soothsayers.
We're not starting off very well, I'll give you that.
Okay, to explain to people who may be listening to this at another time, Kevin McCarthy this week dropped out of the speaker's race after it became apparent that, one, he could not get 218 votes in his own caucus, and two, he may have a dark secret in his personal life that would be used against him if he tried to run.
Yeah, don't they all, though?
So now there's no clear front runner, and it seems like there's not even a good compromise candidate.
It seems that Boehner might have the job for the rest of his life.
Well, yeah, because he's going to be there until they find a replacement, right?
I know, poor bastard.
Well, both sides have agreed if Paul Ryan takes the job, both sides agree. So that's their compromise candidate.
Yeah, but Paul Ryan wants to be the president someday, and there is no – I just don't – I know they said he's thinking about it this week, but this weekend. I'm very skeptical because I don't think he's got a prayer at a presidential aspirations if he's the House Speaker, because
it will destroy him. Absolutely. Mean, no one will be happy with anything he does.
Yeah,
I mean, and go on. I'm sorry.
I'm not happy with him already. I actually find this to be highly ironic, in that the House Freedom Caucus and the folks in the conservative wing within the caucus became so tribal. And again, I talked about this when Boehner left, the big problem of the increasing tribalism within the conservative wing of the party. I'm going to find an excuse to bang on about it every week, and these idiots gave me a reason this week. They've basically thrown out a guy who opposed the bank bailout, something that, you know, still upsets a number of people, and basically completely degrades, if not wipes out, whatever economic arguments Republicans can make. They knocked out somebody who opposed the bank bailout, Kevin McCarthy, and they are now, including the House Freedom Caucus, coming around and trying to pressure Paul Ryan, who did vote for the bank bailout, to take the job for him. It's basically to millions of Americans who don't really know who Paul Ryan is and who don't know what the heck we're talking about for the most part, they're going to see that another bank bailout supporter is now leading the party in the House, and it's going to be they're going to think, okay, they still don't get it.
But there is a memo circulating in the House from one of the Freedom Caucus explaining just that. And so there's one or two members of the Freedom Caucus who aren't happy for those exact same reasons.
Well, they and I are the only three we're the only three sane people left in the entire Republic.
Well, but what's funny, though, is it's so splintered that they're just looking to get someone that they can all agree on, even if the problem is they're going to have a Boehner situation again, from the sounds of it. You know, what's it going to be like in 2 years? The same story.
What are the chances of the Republican House getting someone who's not an elected representative right now? Because you don't have to be a member of the House right now. You could be Newt Gingrich could come in. Donald Trump could come in and be Speaker.
Right. And they floated Gingrich's name. I think Sean Hannity floated that early in the week, starting this ball rolling. And
sure,
they've talked about, they have mentioned Mitt Romney. There have been some other people that were mentioned. I think Charlie Sheen's name came up.
Charlie Sheen, I think that's the best one I've heard so far. How would that work? I mean, if he's not a member, but he doesn't get a vote then, right? I mean, he gets to do all the stuff that House...
The scheduling and the backroom politicking.
Actually, that would be a sweet gig for someone who's into that then.
Yeah.
Yeah. You get the golf times.
Seriously.
10 in bed.
If they're not an elected member of Congress, is there a salary to it?
No, so it needs to be someone like Mitt, who's independently wealthy. That would work well for him.
I bet there's a salary. I bet there's an office. There's got to be something. That's a good question.
Now, I want to talk for a minute about John Boehner's role in all of this, because this is not really political. It's more personal, but I'm going to do it anyways. You know, from the moment that he announced his resignation, the press has covered it as, oh, this is the happiest day in this guy's life. Look at him. He was singing zippity-doo-dah when he made the announcement, and he was planning this a year ago, but he couldn't do it because Eric Cantor got defeated. I don't buy that for a split second. This guy cried the day he became Speaker of the House. He talked about it as being his lifelong dream. And, you know, you don't leave a job like that after, you know, under 5 years unless you are pressured out. This guy had...
It's been less than 5 years. God, it feels like he's been there for 20 freaking years.
He It was 2011.
Okay. He also cries at everything, though, too. So
yes, and he also sings Zippity Doodah a lot. So the people, the reporters who I've heard this quoted several times on CNN, he was singing Zippity Doodah. He was so happy. He was doing that through the budget battles with Obama. That's just one of his ploys. So I'm just not buying that this guy is like, you know, the happiest man in Washington, D.C., and I'm done with my rant.
I have two thoughts on that. One is that that Boehner speech is on the C-SPAN podcast feed, if anyone wants to check it out. But the second one is I bet that this is not the job he thought it was going to be. It does not look like anything went his way. The rise of the – I don't want to call him the Freedom Caucus. I'll call him the assholes. Those assholes in Congress, the 40 or 50 of them, have made this a horrible government for everybody involved in the legislative branch and the executive branch. I can't imagine that he had the experience that he thought he was going to have.
Well, I just want to say I hope he stays in Congress because I do not want to see this man on Dancing with the Stars.
Oh, you know it, though.
Oh, you know it.
You know they're gunning for him, too. He's probably been practicing. Don't even kid yourself.
The Speaker of the House does get a salary. It's $223,500.
In addition?
I believe that is while the average the minority and majority leader gets $193,400. Delegates get $174,000.
Right. I don't know this for a fact, but that 270 number was not an addition. It was a full salary. So if you're not a member of Congress, is someone else collecting a full salary for that district in Ohio and the speaker is getting the additional 274? I don't know.
No. I think that's his pay.
I think it's just likely that up to this point, the speaker has always been a member of the House, mm-hmm. and I suspect that the speaker will continue to be a member of the House. It might take the caucus.
So what do you guys do you think? Well, one of the things that the ideas that's sort of been out there this last week is this idea that maybe there will be some sort of centrist candidate, some kind of a moderate Republican that can go to the Democrats in order to get those 40, 50 votes so that they don't need to go to the far right wing. Do you guys think that's how feasible do you think that is? Because that would be incredible if the Tea Party actually brought about a moderate speaker that figured out how to get around them.
No, it's not the Tea Party that would do that. It would be the moderates who need to get beyond those 40 votes that are holding out.
And
here's the irony. To do that, which could absolutely be done, you have to break what, as you guys know, is called the Hastert rule. And they don't want to do that. The Hastert rule, of course, for those who don't know, is that the Republicans will not pass any legislation relying on the Democrats. If they don't have 218 votes for it in their own caucus, they will not use the Democrats' help to get something passed. And I find it ironic that they're still holding on to a rule that's named after Dennis Hastert, but that's a different story.
It is indeed, but they have run afoul of that rule a couple of times. I don't think they'll do it with a speaker election, though. I think they'll want to try to find someone who can get to 218. It may take a while to get there, unless they really do beat Paul Ryan over the head and make him take the job. But I think, you know, this is something where, again, in the rest of the world, most of the rest of the world outside of the Anglosphere, what is now considered the Republican Party would be two separate parties. There would be a Christian Democratic Party and a more liberal, like the Free Democrats in Germany. Of course, they're on the outs now these days. But we are really talking about, again, within the establishment wing of the party and the conservative wing of the party. The conservative wing of the party has just become far too tribal. And they're showing it over and over and over again. And it's going to continue to happen for a whole bunch of reasons. There's a lot of distrust within the party. There's the fact that they have now lost twice at the presidential level, including for a lot of folks, an election that they thought they should win. Not necessarily saying they're right. There's a lot of thought that within the Republican Party that they should have won in 2012. There's a lot of people who are convinced that they're not going to win in 2016. And, you know, in the NFL, they say winning solves a lot of things. The Republicans haven't been winning lately. They haven't won at a national level in over 10 years. And this is the sort of thing that you get. You get these kind of divisions. You get this kind of nuttiness within a political party. The Democrats, to some extent, had this sort of experience in the late 1980s and the early 90s. It was not easy for Bill Clinton to cobble that party together and move it forward in 1992. And in fact, even he only won 43% of the vote. So this is something that happens when parties lose twice in a row and start to get the feeling that they're not going to win a third time either.
And you feel speaking like of that, less can we now move to the other party? We only have about a few minutes left in the show. We have a debate coming up this week. The Democrats are going to be holding their first debate. And obviously, everybody's very excited about that. It's going to be on Tuesday. And I'm wondering, Jonah, what are you looking for there?
Well, okay. So what I would really be looking for there, if this were a perfect world, would be to see my favorite Democratic candidate, Larry Lessig, school them all. And but he's not there, which is interesting because he is polling just as well or better than O'Malley, Webb, and Chafee. And he has raised more money than them, but they've decided not to let him in the debate anyway. So I guess that leaves me just wondering, two things, I guess. I like Lincoln Chafee. I like people that have been an elected official in one party and then go through some kind of a crisis and then change to another party. So I really do want to see how he presents himself. I don't think much is going to happen, but I'm looking forward to seeing him. And then really, having not seen a live video of Bernie Sanders, just heard some audio stuff with him, is he truly the crazy socialist, or can he possibly be presidential standing on that stage? And for me, those are the two things I'm looking for.
I am going to predict that the answer to both questions, Jonah, is actually no. I don't think Bernie Sanders is crazy, but I don't think this is, you know, debates are not, the debates these days are not really debates as much as they are joint press conferences. I don't see these candidates really lighting into each other. I certainly don't see Bernie Sanders trying to do it because that's not really his modus operandi. What really is going to happen is this debate is going to go. It's going to happen, and then everybody's going to go, well, they really needed to lay a glove on Hillary Clinton and they couldn't do it. Blah 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 blah. And this debate, this may be the first debate on the calendar, but it'll be the last debate in importance. And afterwards, things will just kind of go back to the status quo, Annie. A little. I think Clinton will actually probably get a boost out of this because I think the expectations for her are lower than they are for everybody else. And we're just not going to pay attention to these anymore. And it's going to continue to be Hillary's race to lose. And I don't see her losing it.
Can I jump in here? Because while I actually hope, DJ, that you're right, I'm praying with my fingers crossed that you're right. I think exactly the opposite is going to happen. So here's my prediction. I believe that we're talking about, you know, Clinton, Martin O'Malley, Lincoln Chafee, Jim Webb, they all have very kind of standard, slow, thoughtful types of presentation styles. Bernie, as we all know, is going to be hot. He's going to be fired up. And my sense is he is going to be the most charismatic of those candidates on camera. I think the spin on social media by the Bernie bots is going to be unrelenting that he won the debate. I believe what you're going to see is those little graphs that they do, the live, you know, real-time polling of people where you see the graph going up and down. You're going to see a lot of peaks for Sanders because, again, he gets very emotional, and that's what people respond to when they're turning those dials. They're not really thinking about, wow, is that really payable? You know, is that something that, you know, Hillary can actually get through a bifurcated Congress? No, they're going to be listening to Bernie talking about how the 1% has more wealth than the entire planet. And it's going to go over big. And my prediction, and I hope I'm wrong, but my prediction is Bernie will be spun as the winner. And within a week, we may see the national polls closing quite a bit more than I would hope they would.
Bernie may be spun as the winner. I don't see the polls moving much except for a brief hiccup that maybe lasts a day or two. This could, I mean, we have to remember the first Republican debate. There were certain people who were perceived as the winners. It was considered Donald Trump's worst night. The polls never really moved.
I think you're crazy, Kevin. I think you're crazy. I think.
All right. Did anyone watch Bernie Sanders on Meet the Press this morning?
Yes.
All right. So my favorite part was Chuck Todd goes, "So how are you going to work with a Republican Congress and a Republican Senate?" He goes, "Well, we don't know for sure." He goes, No. Chuck Todd actually said, "How are you going to work with them?" He goes, "Well, I'm going to, you know, ask for something just ridiculous," which he didn't say it that way, but come on. And Congress is going to say no, Senate. And then the people are going to rise up and come to the gates and shake the gates. And I was sitting there going, "No, we're not. We're
going to sit here." That's why this whole thing is okay. Everyone on that stage on Wednesday or Tuesday night knows who the nominee is already. Every one of them. They can say what they want. They can do what they want. Exactly. The bottom line is this is silly, and they all know that it works better for their party if they don't beat up their nominee that bad. Because they saw in 2012 what that looks like. I mean, Mitt Romney came out, and his hair was messed up, man. It was ugly. I mean, even Santorum was hanging on till the very end. The bottom line is that they've seen what it looks like to have your candidate beat up and spending all that money early. They are not going to go hard on her. I'm telling you, she won't be touched by any of this stuff. Come whatever March, April next year, we'll know that I was right, because the bottom line, they know what happens. So this is like sparring partners, and not even tough sparring partners.
No. And you know what? Anybody, and like I said, I'm a liberal Democrat, and even I'm like, nope, no, we're not. if I haven't gone screaming to Washington yet over some of the most ridiculous things for government shutdowns, and if I haven't gone, you know, I'm not doing it now.
Yeah.
So for free colleges. And oh, that was it. He said, "I want to give the kids free college. And when they don't, the kids will come and demand free college." And I was like, no, they won't.
Yeah.
They won't, because they're too busy, you know, being hip.
Yeah.
And they will hear from policymakers all over the Anglosphere who will tell them that Canada and the United Kingdom have actually moved away from free colleges for all. And what they have found is that if they charge the wealthy students, they can use that money to offset costs for the poorer students. So free college for all actually gets in the way of that by making it harder for these schools to accommodate poorer and less well-off students. And Bernie Sanders can do everything he wants to make people think that his name is Yiddish for Pat Robertson, but that doesn't change the reality of this. And I don't think it's going to make that big a difference in the end.
Nope. Well, I got to tell you, I've never been so happy to be called crazy in my life, and it's happened quite a few times. So,
okay, we just got a couple minutes left. Let's talk a little bit about who's bringing the money in for the Republicans, and then we're gonna have another vote before we go. We're gonna weigh in on who we think's gonna be the nominee if it's changed at all. So,
how about instead of who's gonna be the nominee, who's dropping out?
Oh, that's cool. Okay, who's gonna drop out next? That's fair. But okay, so
we can do both. I mean,
third quarter, the reports, the money reports have come in, and I mean, I'm looking at them right now. You guys came up with them, but Rubio had $6 million. To Cruz's $12 million. That's interesting to me. So Carson
had $20 million.
Yeah, $20 million for Carson, which
Are you seriously?
From what I've heard, Ben Carson also has a really high burn rate. So it may very well be that he tried to spend a lot of money to make a lot of money.
Well, he's surging right now. I mean, there's no doubt that he's definitely making waves right now. But
yeah, he must be robbing Popeye operations to be making that much money.
He pulled the gun on himself. Is that what you're saying?
Now, the fact that Cruz out raised Rubio is interesting, and it maybe tells us that the first debate Luntz had that focus group where apparently all the Trump people went over to Cruz, and we all kind of laughed at him for it. This is actually the one piece of data that says that maybe Luntz knew a little bit about what he was talking about. Rubio's best debate was the second debate, which came closer to the much closer to the mm-hmm. end of the fundraising quarter. Mm-hmm. So that may have been why his number was low, or maybe I'm just spinning that because Rubio is my guy. I'll admit I can fall into that kind of trap. But what will be interesting to see is what happens with the numbers with the polling numbers, not necessarily the money numbers, because at this point everybody is going to have money to get. Probably going to have enough money except for, you know, Jindal or Gilmore and such. And they're doing kind of vanity projects. We'll probably have enough to get to Iowa and New Hampshire. Where they go after that depends not just on how much money they've raised, but on how much they have spent. And, you know, Rubio's campaign prides itself on not really spending a whole lot of money. We'll see if that's real or if that's just spin as we move forward. I'm actually going to stick my neck out and say that, Rand Paul is going to be the first one to back out because he has a Senate seat to run for.
Mm-hmm.
And I think he may shift focus over the next few months because he realizes probably the best thing for a Republican to do in 2016 is not get nominated for president.
That's fair. I think it's Chris Christie. I mean, and let's just stipulate that we're not talking about the JV guys because no one cares about when Jindal goes out. But it's... the varsity team, I think it's Christie's out next.
I think it's Rand Paul. I agree with DJ.
Yeah, I guess Rand Paul.
You know, Carly did not make much money at all. And she's been not having a good time. So I think it's either her or Christie.
Interesting. Because she's still considered top tier, though, at this point.
That's a bold prediction because I do not see that one happening. I think she's in at least through Iowa and New Hampshire.
I only say that because she's considered top tier, but our top tier is such a joke at this point that, I mean, Rubio is the only one that looks vaguely presidential to me out of the whole group of them, to tell you the truth. Cruz maybe, but he's so crazy that I'm kind of, but yeah, I think it's me, Christie. So, all right. You guys, we did really well. Let's wrap it up. Thank you again for spending some time tonight. And
we're going to do a bonus episode this week.
That's right. The Democratic debate is Tuesday night, and we're going to be having something come out soon after that. So,
yep,
that's right. Our guess is that CNN isn't really going to talk about it too much, so we have to cover.
That's
for
that. Right. We got to make sure that they're getting it right. All right. Well, we'll see you again next week, you guys.
All right.
Thank you for listening to the More Perfect Union podcast. Be sure to subscribe to the show on iTunes and check out the website at moreperfectunionpodcast.com. If you have any questions or comments for the More Perfect Union podcast crew, you can email us at moreperfectunionpodcast@gmail.com. We'll talk to you next week.